So on to item seven, review of the total portfolio performance for the period ending June 30th, 2020. Presentation from Verus. Scott, welcome.
Welcome. Good afternoon, everybody. I hope it was a productive closed session. Before we get started and I share my screen and go through the market environment and performance, I want to just spend a brief second and introduce slash reintroduce you to Stuart Odell, who is a colleague of mine who most of you met through the risk tolerance assessment interview process remotely. But I wanted to make sure I introduced him to the full board in the full board setting and staff. Stuart is a fairly recent addition to the Verus team. He's been with us a little over 6 months now. He came on right when the pandemic lockdown started, so he has not been working out of any of our offices yet. He comes to us from Intel, where he ran their multi-billion dollar retirement program, and he's got years of experience and deep expertise, and we're really thrilled to have him. And he's going to be joining me on the Contra Costa Employees Retirement Association service team. So with that, just welcome, Stuart. And now I suppose I should put up my screen. So I'm looking to share my screen.
Scott, but did you have something? Okay. Scott Gordon, did you have something?
Oh.
I saw a hand up.
I was just waving to Stuart, so sorry.
I was just saying hello, and I'm excited to be supporting you guys. It was great to meet most of you during the risk survey, and just really looking forward to digging in and working with Scott and Tim and the rest of the Contra Costa team, as well as you guys, to support you on your plan. So I'm really excited to be there.
Welcome.
Okay, so I have shared my screen. If anybody could just give a little high sign and let me know that it's up, good. Okay, so I'm gonna spend just a few minutes on the investment landscape, and then I'll move into performance. You know, normally and oftentimes I'll go through multiple slides and kind of make some points, but I'm really just going to speak to the market environment and what's going on out there. Most of you know that it's COVID related, it's Fed related, it's not particularly related to fundamentals, and so I just want to make some comments about that. The domestic risk market, as I'll represent it by the S&P 500, has really gone down and recovered very quickly relative to previous market dislocations. You know, it was a quarter down and a quarter back, and we've broken record highs that were set back in February. It went from about 3,300 down about 33% to about 2,200, and then came back. Zoomed back up 60% to about 34. I think today it's about 3480. So it was a really quick turnaround, really driven by the fact that the Fed swooped in, brought their playbook that they were very familiar with from the global financial crisis, provided all kinds of liquidity, supported markets, made sure markets were functioning. And you know, interesting fun fact is that at the peak of the financial crisis, their balance sheet, the support that they were providing to the markets in the form of liquidity, was about $4 trillion, up from, you know, under $1 trillion. And they never really got much below that. They started to work that off, but then we got the global pandemic came in, and they immediately boosted their balance sheet to about $7 trillion. So a lot of support. It looks like they'll be continuing to support the market for some time to come. They have said now that they're going to keep rates around zero, or the speculation is they're going to keep rates around zero for another 5 years. There's talk that they aren't too worried about inflation, that they're going to allow inflation to drift above target to continue to support the economy and, with easy money. And so it looks like, you know, the Fed is here to stay. With respect to COVID, you know, the markets seem to be pretty sanguine about it, with given the level of Fed support. And the situation has continued to improve. We had the infection rate is trailing down, the 7-day averages continues to move down. The death rate is moving down a little bit as well, a little bit tougher, the rate of decline. The 7-day average is down below about 1,000 now. And the news on vaccine continues to come in and be fairly positive in terms of the expectations with respect to when that's going to be available. And all of that sort of flies in the face of what's happening to the real economy, where fundamentals, although improving and improving a little bit quicker than most folks expected, is still, we're in pretty dire straits in terms of the level of growth and the rate of growth relative to where we were, to where the economy was back in February. All that says that it's a really uncertain time out there, and you know, you guys are well positioned to get through most environments, as we saw in your performance through the first and second quarters, with your diversification and your functionally focused portfolio investment strategy. And we're just going to have to wait and see. With that, I'm going to pause, and then I've got a couple of slides I want to show to make a few more points, but just wanted to pause to see if there are any questions or comments. Okay, I am going to take you to, if you're following along with hard copies or electronic copy on another screen, to slide 7 in the first section of our quarterly performance deck. So here you can get sort of a sense of what happened to the real economy, the underlying economic fundamentals in the U.S. at least, relative to where we were a year ago as of June 30th. So a year ago with GDP, we were kind of plugging along at about 2%. That seemed to be a relatively stable trend, sort of slow and steady as she goes. And then the pandemic hit, and the most recent quarter over quarter was down 9.5%. So a big downdraft in the economy. If this were annualized, it would be a 33% drop in economic activity. But as you know, we've started to come off bottom. Inflation, again, turning down. We were right around the Fed target of 2%. Inflation is down to about 1.2 as of the May 31st reading. It's ticked up a little bit since then, but still below target. And the point there, as I mentioned, is that the Fed appears to be willing to allow inflation to drift up and over target, given the fact that it's been below target for so long, and the fact that they do not want to cut short any economic growth. The Fed funds target rate, you can see, you know, was moving up a year ago, and then they had to drop it right back down. And as I mentioned, it's expected to be low for quite some time. The 10-year rate, in line with rates coming down, about 2%, and then at 6:30 it was 0.7, and it's right about there right now. So lots of liquidity due to very cheap money supporting markets. The unemployment rate, as you can see, as you all I'm sure remember, we're at record lows, strong employment, and that moved up considerably and is beginning to work itself down slowly. I'm going to take you now all the way back to the back of the deck. Just make a couple of points to the back of the first section, I should say, on page 48. It's going to make a couple of points about where markets have been. So this eye chart is a pretty good representation of all investment assets and the returns over the near to long term. The table on the upper left-hand portion of the page is domestic equity. The top line, top row on that line, the top row on that page is the S&P 500. And you can see year to date where we were at June 30th, 3.1%, right? So that was down 33% and then on its way back. Just in case you're curious, through the end of July, we'd gone positive 2.4%. So July was a strong month, as and we went positive, and we're even higher above that. So year to date, you know, we're probably around 4 to 5% now. A couple of points here is, if you look at some trends that have been going on for a while, surprisingly so, look at the long-term S&P 500, 14%, right? Well above historical, very long-term averages of around 9 to 10%, by the way. But that's because, right, that does not include the global financial crisis in that 10-year period, and we were coming back off of that and have been pretty strongly since we started to recover in 2009. And then, but look at that 14% relative to international equities. And I'll take my cursor down to the international equity table and look at the second row, which is everything except the US, right? So that's international developed and emerging markets. And you can see a 900 basis point differential there, average annualized. That's 9% per year for 10 years favoring US stocks, which is a huge difference and pretty unheard of. But there's really been a headwind to international relative to US. And then another similar trend, let's go back to the year-to-date numbers, looking in the domestic equity table, looking at the growth versus value. So you see this huge differential between growth stocks and value stocks, and you've probably seen it or recognized it if you follow the financial press. The NASDAQ has been just on a steady tear relative to, say, the Dow or the S&P. And over on a year-to-date basis, you see this 28 percentage point difference, which is just enormous. And that also bleeds all the way back to the 10-year numbers, where we've got about a 700 basis point difference on a 10-year basis. So big differential there. Interestingly, you know, theoretically and over time, value stocks have outperformed growth stocks on average over time. So we've got this big differential, this big headwind to value relative to growth. Couple of other points to make with respect to that, those two trends. I'm gonna take you back up to a couple of pages. The first one being slide 31, just continuing on this value growth trend a little bit. So this is an interesting chart here. It it shows the value growth pricing differential, right? The blue line. So sometimes value's in favor, sometimes growth is in favor, and you have a price disparity. So this goes back to when growth was really in favor, and now value, sorry, was when growth was really cheap relative to value, and now value is cheap relative to growth, right? And then you can look at the outperformance over the next 5 years in this blue line, right? So when value is cheap, growth underperforms, which is the same to say value outperforms over the next 5 years. Similar trends here, right? So not always perfect, but generally when value is cheap, value outperforms over the next 5 years. I bring this up only to, you know, in case anybody's thinking that you ought to be going all in on Apple and Google and Facebook, and the trends suggest that when value is cheap, value will tend to outperform over the next 5 years. And then with respect to the international domestic, I'm going to take you just up a few slides to slide 35. And I want to show you some valuation metrics here. This is the three major sectors of the global equity investment landscape. We got domestic in blue, US in blue, international developed as represented by the EAFE index, and then emerging markets in the green or teal or whatever color it is. So you can see that from a valuation perspective, price to book, price to earnings, price to free cash flow, the US is more expensive than either of the international sectors. International developed, more expensive to emerging markets, being the cheapest. Same thing if you look at the dividend yields, right? This is dividends that you get from these individual stocks over their price. Dividend yields lower in US and earnings yield lower in US. So from a valuation perspective, you know, international stocks look more favorable than US stocks. Not to say that international or emerging markets are a screaming buy, but from a valuation perspective, it would appear that you're getting more for your money in those segments of the market. And with that, I'm going to pause before moving to performance to see if there are any questions or comments. You guys are all wore out from your executive session, right? This is going to be easy.
You never know.
Okay, so let's look at performance, and I'm going to go to the first page, which is the portfolio reconciliation slide, slide two. This just shows where you were 3 months ago and at the beginning of the year, and shows that you have more than caught up in the second quarter, or I should say, you know, from the beginning of the quarter, you exceeded based on big market gains in the second quarter. You had about $100 million outflow and over $600 million in investment gains. And then year to date, you have not quite caught up. So you can see at the beginning of the year, you were about 9.4, under $200 million in net outflows. And then you still are at a net negative for investment change from the beginning of the year. Now, I suspect, or I'm sure, that this number has come up quite a bit since the June 30 measurement date. I don't know what that number is, but I suspect that you're getting pretty close to your beginning of the year market value, if not over it. I'm going to take you back just a couple of pages to slide four and look at asset allocation. So you can see here, relative to your current targets, a little bit overweight in your growth bucket and a little bit underweight in your liquidity and diversifying buckets. And those weightings actually were favorable to you through the second quarter. And let's take performance now on the next page. So you can see net of fee performance for the quarter to date, 7.4%. You outperformed in the growth bucket, where you have, of course, the largest pool of your assets, and also your overweight there. So both of those were contributors to that outperformance for the quarter. Slight underperformance in your diversifying bucket, and then outperformance in your liquidity bucket. And then, you know, let's focus on the year-to-date numbers, because I think that this was just a really good field test for your functionally focused portfolio investment strategy. And you can see outperformance 2.8% versus 3.2%, outperformance again in the growth portfolio, not as much diversifying benefit in the diversifying portfolio. And we'll talk about that just a little bit. And that is reflected also down in these correlation numbers, where you can see the correlation between the growth and diversifying components increased during the market drawdown. And then, you know, of course, good protection and actually good returns in your liquidity bucket. I'm gonna come back to slide six, and I'm gonna go right to the total fund rankings and some detail. So here again, you have this is gross of fees now that we're looking at, so we can get these rankings relative to other funds. The good news here, again, as I mentioned, is kind of a field test on functionally focused portfolio through a very quick market cycle and good performance relative to policy. But what might give you more comfort, and I try not to focus too much on, is relative to your peers, right? So through from year to date, the down and then the up, you ranked in the top quintile amongst your peers. Again, that came from, outperformance in your growth bucket, And then you know, good protection in your liquidity bucket and reasonable protection in your diversifying bucket. I'm going to go to a couple of outlier managers now, just to dive down into the details a little bit. And bear with me. Talk about some really solid performers and one performer that has disappointed relative to the benchmark and its peers. So you look at Pierford in your international, by the way, your international sleeve in your growth bucket, very strong, largely due to Pierford. You can see the 1 year number. Actually, let's just continue focusing on the year to date. The year to date number there, about 10 percentage points above the benchmark, ranking in the fourth percentile. You know, the easy to explain, larger capitalization tailwind, growthy tailwind, underweight financial services, underweight emerging markets relative to its benchmark and probably its peers, but just a very strong performance there. And then down in global equity as well, you had Artisan, and largely for the same reasons, growthier, overweight to good sectors in the market, healthcare and IT, as you know, are doing very well in this market. So a couple of really good, solid outlier outperformers. And then looking at PIMCO's research affiliates emerging markets fund. So underperformance there. Now, one thing I will say is that we're currently benchmarking them against an emerging markets core benchmark, which is a little unfair for these guys because they do have a value bias, pretty significant value bias. And that is really the explanation for their underperformance there. Value bias, smaller cap, underweight to the stronger areas of the market, just sort of systemically, you would expect them to have a tailwind when value is outperforming growth. Now, I did look to see if we were, how they would do relative to a value benchmark. And, you know, they still would have underperformed, but the value benchmark, instead of negative 9.8 for year to date, is negative 18. It doesn't, you know, save them completely, but when you compare them to a benchmark that more is reflective of their style, it's not quite as dire, and very understandable performance there. So here I'll pause as I move back to slide 6. And this is really the last point I wanted to make. If you look at, so this is risk and return. And if you look at, so the return is along the y-axis, risk as measured by standard deviation along the x-axis, right? You can intuitively think where you want to be on this chart, right? You want to be sort of upper left with high return and low risk. And you guys are, you know, on your way there and in good position, right? Quite a bit lower. I should explain, the lines represent the median funds risk and return. The dots are all the peers in this universe. These are public funds greater than $1 billion. And then the shaded area is the, you know, it's the one standard deviation around the median, or the mean, I should say. So you guys have much less risk than your peers, and you're right on the median return of your peers. So you can think how that might be reflected statistically. If you look at your Sharpe ratio at 0.45, right? That's the efficiency of your portfolio. It's essentially the return, the excess return over the risk-free rate. Let's just say the return divided by the risk, and you're at 0.45, and that puts you in the, wait for it. Where'd that page go? Hold on. Okay, this is bad showmanship here.
Well, you did tell us to wait for it.
Oh, gosh. All right, well, I can't find it, but I'm going to say, based on memory, that puts you in the 17th percentile relative to your peers in terms of portfolio efficiency, which is really strong. So the thing to think about here is, do you want to, or do you have an appetite for increasing the risk of the portfolio a little bit to take advantage of that high Sharpe ratio and maybe, you know, maybe move a little bit to the right, but up into that, that northwest quadrant. And so, you know, certainly not a question I want to pose to you now, but we do have a framework to think about that question coming up in the asset liability study and the risk tolerance work that we just did.
Scott, I think you're looking for slide 27 there.
Okay. I was looking for, I wrote slide 27 input on a sheet that I had in front of me that somehow it disappeared. But anyway, messy desk syndrome. So unless there are any other questions or comments, that concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Any trustee questions or comments?
I have one in general, and it's not necessarily with respect to the performance an evaluation report. It's more general question about wanting to get your views on the future of core real estate in light of what we know today. To get some feedback on that. It just seems to be at a time when we're all working from home and everybody I know is working from home, and I have clients and friends who bailed out of leases who have retooled, if you will. Companies are telling people to stay home through August 21. I mean, what's your take on what that means?
So the big question is what it means over the long term versus maybe the short term, right? So over the short term, there's no question that it will be office will continue to struggle, maybe residential with rental payments that can't be made. It seems like this just accelerates the downturn in retail. Certain retail, big box stores, strip malls, et cetera. I have heard from real estate managers, though, that over the longer term, they remain optimistic with thinking about factors like, the notion of social distancing. While people may come back into the office, you may need more space to bring them back into the office. The notion that while there are a lot of people that are getting very used to being at home and working productively from home, there's also a lot of anecdotal evidence that people miss the physical interaction. So it's a big question around office and what's going to happen to office. And I think it's just a big wait and see. In the near term, you are seeing revaluations starting to come through for a lot of these core funds. And so the concerns that you are talking about and thinking about are having valuation impacts in real estate.
If I could build on Scott's question a little bit, are you seeing that or hearing about it anecdotally in terms of new projects in the pipeline and especially funding for new projects? Is there a slow down in the new funding, or is there still an appetite to go out and get steel out of the ground?
So slow down for now in the very short term. But interestingly, our real estate research group is looking at value add and opportunistic real estate as a good place to be putting capital now in anticipation of opportunities coming up over the next 3 to 5 years.
Interesting. What do you see? I'm sorry, there was a related question. Do you know anything about campus housing? Or a lot of these, one of the things that we're dealing with, as I recall, we're in one of these, where they've got campus housing. Is that slowed down or is speeding up?
Student housing in general is getting hurt pretty badly. I know that from personal anecdotal evidence that my son today, his college just said that they are going remote for the first 100% remote for the first semester this year, and then also, you know, just hearing in the markets that student housing is really suffering.
Scott, one quick question, well, one broader question maybe. We are
going down a path of massive increases in debt nationally. We had may have been your input that the balance sheet for the Fed went to whatever it was, 7, 8. Basically, it looked like what happened is the Treasury issued $4 trillion worth of bonds and Fed turned around and bought them. If that isn't money printing, in another word, I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
The reaction you get, at least I get out of Washington, is that things really don't cost anything anymore on both sides. Whatever amount we would like to spend, we can spend by just effectively printing it. Where do you see that taking us?
Nowhere good over the long term. Over the short term, you know, it's a sugar rush. Companies can act irresponsibly because they don't have the, you know, burden of debt to keep them in line. So there's not a huge differential between good company and bad company. From a future debt burden perspective, you know, I don't know how to look at it other than at some point this has got to be paid back. So we're basically borrowing, we're stealing future wealth to spend today, and it's going to have to be paid back. It's just classic, you know, running up your credit card, and so you got, you know, better times today than you will have in the future. I don't know another way to look at it, and it's worrisome. And the market does not really seem to be factoring that in, or, you know, they're factoring it in that it's so far down the road that it doesn't really have a huge impact on today's valuations. It's that's my biggest concern.
No, Scott, we saw a presentation not too far in the past suggested the savings rate was up, the default rate was low, people were making their mortgage payments, they're making their rental payments. And then it wasn't a week later that I saw that a number of the big institutions were booking or reserving for big defaults. Can you explain that kind of contradiction?
So I can speculate, right? And it's because the fiscal policy came in and supported current spending with the Pension Protection Act and other you know, fiscal policy levers to keep money in people's pockets. And so the current statistics are not bad because the government just said, yeah, we're going to backstop you. And I think the banks are worried about when that runs out. So they're starting to reserve.
Should we buy or sell banks?
You know, John, I wish I don't know. I don't even want to hazard a guess.
Hey, you mind if I ask one quick question here for Scott? We talked about the potential disruption in commercial real estate, maybe student housing. Can you outline the plan's actual exposure to kind of real estate in general? I see we have a REIT position, we have some private real estate. If you could just give a general, you know, general strokes, what's our actual risk there?
I don't know that off the top of my head, and I wouldn't be able to get to it quickly in the report. I'm gonna turn to Tim to see if he is able to respond to that question.
Yeah, I don't have that in front of me at the moment, but in broad strokes, office would be our largest position, followed by multifamily housing. Then we have smaller positions in retail, hospitality, and very small position in industrials. So if you look at the dominant factor driving the results, whether this is in value add or opportunistic, it is office, front and center, and multifamily a close second.
It may also be interesting to note, Jay, that the managers that I was reviewing before the meeting, their holdings are underweight real estate. That is, you know, to the extent that REITs are in the benchmark, the ones that I was looking at were underweight real estate.
Great, thank you.
And so, Jay, just to add on to that, I mean, there's a number of questions about sector performance, and we've been tracking on a manager by manager basis what's going on, basically with, you know, both valuation and rental collection. And we're actually seeing office hold up better than expected, close to flat. So rent collection is down slightly. Valuations are probably down 5 to 10%. We expected a bigger markdown there, and we may see a bigger markdown in the future. But that one's held up fairly well. Multifamily is the area we've been focused on front and center. And again, rental, I think we continue to see these Census Bureau surveys that most renters don't think they're going to be able to make the next month's rent. And then lo and behold, we come along to another month end and we're getting, you know, 85% rent collection. So properties are holding up in terms of operations. What we're looking at now is potential impacts on valuations. And it's been slight so far, but certainly the expiration of some of the benefit of the stimulus checks and some of the unemployment benefits is what we're looking at in terms of, does this start to impact the September performance? And we won't see that for a little while yet.
I think it's a really interesting market now. That kind of the elevated kind of equity index performance is really deceiving, right? It's a very narrow market. You have all of these kind of potential risks, whether it's the end of stimulus, you have the election coming up, potential China trade war. And Scott, you kind of outlined state of the macro at the beginning of your presentation. I was wondering if you saw any kind of near-term risks that we should start to think about, if there's any anything pressing that the board should consider.
So, I mean, you mentioned the risks, right? And there are others, but you mentioned the big ones. The question is when and if those risks begin to be reflected in the market. And with it, the market will have to overcome the Fed support, right? And the Fed support is powerful. And the Fed support is, you know, you say there's not much inflation out there, but there is. The inflation is in investment assets. That's what the liquidity is driving prices up. So unless and until the Fed pulls its support away, which I can't imagine happening, you know, then it's a matter of the market saying, well, this can't go on forever, and I don't want to be in the market because it can't go on forever. And until that happens, you know, you will see investors climbing that wall of worry. And I speculate that you'll see markets maintaining high valuation levels.
Great. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments for Scott? Okay, doesn't appear so. So thank you so much, Scott. We appreciate the update.
You bet. I'm just going to turn my camera off and continue to listen.
Sounds good. Now we'll go on to item 7B, presentation from staff. Tim Price, you have the floor.
Sure. And I just need to share my screen here. Waiting for my little icon to light up. There we go. Bear with me. I'm actually in the office for the first time in I don't know how long on a new computer. So hopefully this works like my laptop does. We can go through it fairly quickly here. What you're looking at in front of you is the quarterly CIO report, where we talk about how the performance of each functional sub-portfolio performed relative to its own expectations and time frame, and then how that rolls up to the total fund. And just as a reminder, this is all in contrast to the Verisk report. This is measured against a simple target index. So this is saying, if we took a publicly traded index that represented each of the functional sub-portfolios, the broadest possible, most representative piece of an index, and put that to work, and, you know, didn't try to outperform in private markets, and didn't you know, go through all of the work that we do to build a diversified portfolio, you know, did all of that work pay off or not? And so before I step into that, I just, you know, want to echo Scott's comments. Like, this has been an extraordinary year, and every now and then it's important to step back and remember in the past 9 months, we've had an impeachment vote in the Senate. We've had record highs in equity. We had the advent of COVID-19. We've had the lockdown. We've had the equity market collapse. Fed intervention, as Scott talked about. We had the fiscal intervention. Oil prices collapsed when the Saudis and the Russians couldn't come to an agreement on production, equity rebound, and treasuries at all-time lows. So if there's ever a scenario where we don't know what the portfolio is going to go through in the future, we've just lived through it here. So I think these are extraordinary times. We want to talk about what diversification does for us in these types of extraordinary times.
Tim, so, you forgot to acknowledge that Kanye West also entered the presidential race.
I apologize for that grievous oversight. So let's step through this. I think, you know, I want to talk about some areas that we're concerned about and you're watching very closely, but I do want to acknowledge up front, the total fund is performing as expected. We talked about Sharpe ratios in the Barron's report, and again, against the simple target index over 5 and 10 year periods, over the time frame that we judge the total fund, we are producing returns higher than the simple target index at lower risk, so higher Sharpe ratios. We have a few laggard periods in the past year, but we have a lot of noise in there as well. So we get out to that 5 year period and we're still putting up the numbers we expect there with our more complex portfolio. So that's working. I think the other thing I want to acknowledge that it worked very well throughout the first and second quarters was the dynamism of the functionally focused portfolio. So we drew down the risk diversifying, you know, it protected, did protect as well as we would have wanted to, but it did protect relative to what, you know, broad equity markets did. And then we redeployed that into some credit and equity investments in April and May. And then we've more recently been able to harvest some of those gains in our annual rebalancing here. So let me turn to page 3 and talk a little bit about the performance of each functional sub-portfolio. So this is just relative to our expectations. Again, liquidity program, short duration, high quality, paying the benefits on a very predictable basis for meeting expectations across the board there. With the growth allocation, this is something where we've actually had change from the prior quarter. We're looking at trailing 5 year numbers of 6.4%. So that's, you know, on an absolute basis meeting expectations. Relative to the MSCI ACWI, which is that global equity benchmark, we went from way ahead last quarter because we protected when the equity market fell dramatically in the first quarter. The equity market rebounded dramatically in the second quarter, where ACWI was up 19% and our growth portfolio was up 9%. So, you know, we're slightly behind. I'm going to call that pretty much flat relative to the index. So slightly below expectations, but we're, you know, really, really close. We're within 10 basis points of the benchmark there. And we would expect that when there's an equity market snapback and we have a more defensive posture, while we'd like to maintain a premium, we can understand why there would be a collapse in our excess returns over the past 5 years there. But on an efficiency basis, we're still putting up a Sharpe ratio, trailing 5 year Sharpe ratio that's superior to the global equity benchmark. So I'd say within growth, the things that are not working as expected, again, not necessarily manager specific, style specific, and Scott touched on this, value investing is lagging growth investing by an enormous margin. Pretty much numbers we haven't seen since the late 1990s with the tech run-up. Emerging markets are underperforming developed markets. And I think that largely goes to both the Fed intervention in the United States and other central bank interventions in the G7 or G10 countries. Certainly we saw some unprecedented moves by the European Central Bank, by the Bank of England, Bank of Japan. So I think the dominant factor driving the markets in developed arenas locally or lately has been that just overwhelming support by central banks. Led by the Fed, but backed up by a number of other folks there. And then within risk diversifying, I would say, you know, we've highlighted this as in need of improvement for a number of quarters here. We did see the trailing 5 year number, the real return, so net of inflation, still a negative number, but it has increased from negative 2.3% last quarter to negative 1.4% on a trailing five-year basis this quarter. Clearly, this is a program that's we know, we recognize that it needs to do better. We went through restructuring in the second and third quarters on this, removing the Wellington strategy, introducing the Acadian Mars strategy in August. So this is a little bit of a turnaround in progress, and we'll need to see how it performs over the next year or so here to determine whether we're on the right path there or not. But you put it all together, and the total fund is working largely as expected. As I mentioned, we're putting up the Sharpe ratios better than the index over the trailing 5 and 10 year periods. Let me touch on each functional sub-portfolio briefly and just highlight what's unique here. I think within liquidity, again, functioning as expected, some of the things that jump out here would be SITS duration is up at 3 years. They saw an opportunity with some longer dated bonds that they were allowed to buy within the strategy, and it pursued that. Now they're starting to harvest that, so we would expect that duration to start dropping over the course of the year as some of those securities mature. I would say the other thing is the insight and SIT performance, north of 4% on a short duration portfolio in this yield environment is higher than expected. So we'll call that a short-term gain led by the collapse in the yield curve that we've seen over the past 6 months or so. Within the growth allocation, just taking a look at asset basis here, you start to see the yellows, the product asset growth. You see some large negative numbers. This is starting to be reflective of those value strategies underperforming growth strategies over the past year. And we can see that clearly on page six, where the trailing 1 year returns, I mean, we have a spread from positive 22% on Artisan to as low as negative 19% on emerging market value. So, I mean, we have just a massively differentiated market over the past year. The trailing 5 year numbers, again, we're starting to see quite a bit of differentiation there. I did mark a number of managers as not performing in line with expectations, and that really stems from value not working as expected here. I've mentioned this past two quarters that we're studying value as a factor, and we come up with a reason that it's performing so differently from expectations, and any reason to believe that it shouldn't continue to perform closer to growth over time. And we're really not finding a reason to believe that this bifurcation should persist over time. I think the story short term has been the net beneficiaries of it. Shelter in place have been the Facebooks and Amazon, certainly Netflix, Alphabet has been a great beneficiary here. And energy has been down dramatically. Banks have been out of favor. But if we look long term, we're still seeing companies trading really, really cheap that are generating strong free cash flow. So we continue to believe that those should perform, value should outperform at some point in the cycle here. But you should know that we are actively investigating this and working with our partners, both at Verus and at within the asset management community to study the factor. Yes.
Tim, on the trailing 1 year return is fine. I don't personally get too excited about 1 year return up or down, but over a 5 year period, if you look at Ceredex and Pierford, PIMCO and Allianz, their 5 year returns are basically pretty paltry. So yes. It's not just their 1 year returns. So there's a pattern here, at least for me, that is of some concern.
I would agree. I would say we were watching these in 2019 as they continue to lag. Now we've seen value had lagged for a number of years and then really got crushed in the first half of this year. And so those 1 year numbers that are dramatically negative pulled down the 5 year numbers here. And it certainly caught our attention. It's why we're doing the investigation. The question is always, and the anecdote goes, the most expensive words in investing are, this time it's different. Do we believe that value stopped working and we should trade out of it? We're looking at value as cheap as ever, and we're not finding a fundamental reason that that should persist long term. It can persist for, you know, obviously an extended period of time, but I guess we're still in the camp that value investing should perform closer to growth. Maybe not the significant outperformance it had over the previous 50 years, but this massive differentiation, we're not finding a reason to believe that it should persist over the next 5 years or so. So we're counseling some patients on these, but understood that the big deviation here where they wiped out the past 5 years demands our attention. So let's go to page 8. And within risk diversifying, as I mentioned, significantly restructured over this period. So I'm going to not spend a whole lot of time on this. We did liquidate the Wellington strategy at the end of April, funded Acadian Mars strategy at the beginning of August. And we'll do a deep dive review on the program in September. So I'll save my further comments on this performance and the structure until our board meeting a month from now. We'll do the deep dive. You put it all together in the total fund, and one of the things we track here is upside capture versus downside capture. We want to maintain that spread. What you'll notice here is our downside capture remained about the same. We didn't have a downside scenario in the second quarter. What we had was a massive rally in the equity markets, and we didn't capture as much of it. As I mentioned, the equity markets, global equity markets up 19%, we're up 9% in that portion of the portfolio. So consequently, we didn't capture as much of it. We're still maintaining that spread. I would expect these numbers to start to migrate back away from each other over the next couple of quarters if we have the relatively normal level of volatility, which is a very significant caveat to my comments given everything that's going on in the global markets right now. The other thing we look at from the total fund basis, it's really that second box there, total fund performance. Return, volatility, and Sharpe ratios for 1, 3, 5, and 10-year periods. As I mentioned, we have lagged the simple target index over the past year with the equity markets rebounding as much as they have. The diversification hasn't worked in our favor. We're still positive, but the diversification hasn't worked in our favor when the equity markets are the significant outperformer there. Still maintaining lower risk over 3 years. Again, lagged simple target index slightly by about 40 basis points, but at about a third less risk, so we had a better Sharpe ratio. But then over the 5 and 10 year periods, which are really the relevant time periods for a total fund, we're producing returns that are higher than the simple target index at a lower risk. You put those two together and we're on the right side of the equation here, producing better Sharpe ratios. As Scott mentioned, I think as we go through the asset liability study, we'll take a look at overall risk appetite here, but I think given the risk appetite and the risk posture that we've assumed over this time period, we have been rewarded for it. So that is concludes my comments on the second quarter. I know there have been a number of comments on performance of the markets thus far in the third quarter, given that we're about 7 weeks in, and I'll just offer up on a very preliminary basis. It looks like the total fund is up about 4% through yesterday in the third quarter, which brings our year-to-date number up to about positive 1%. So we have dug our way out of the hole at this point. And I'll take any questions from the trustees.
Any trustee questions or comments?
Let me, Tim, one of the things that I hear talked about far more now than in the past, although I've never personally had much interest in it, is gold. Any thoughts on whether that is a diversifying kind of investment?
Yeah, and that comes up in the context of our global equity manager, First Eagle, who holds a relatively significant gold position. It's always been an interesting component of what they do, and basically being a value manager, if they don't believe they can buy companies at attractive valuations, rather than hold something in cash, which can be debased in their view. They would prefer to hold it in gold, which is a differentiated view from most asset managers. They view it as a permanent store of value. And so, certainly we've had a run-up in gold prices, and this goes to, I think, trying to keep track of this market. With the Fed intervention, with the advent of a significant amount of fear from investors, we're really seeing some unique behaviors. Equity markets at all-time highs, treasuries at all-time lows, gold at all-time highs, which would tend to indicate fear, and credit issuance both from a government and a corporate perspective at all-time highs. So clearly people are borrowing today. Equity markets are at all-time highs, they're inflated, but there's a certain cohort of investors who is buying up gold as a hedge or a diversifier, relative to their performance in financial markets. I always am somewhat cautious about gold because I think it trades on sentiment more than fundamentals. And sentiment to me is it's a more difficult thing to parse in value. Yeah. And certainly I think the Fed's intervention is not fundamentals either. So I think the Fed's intervention and the sentiment around gold probably are two sides of the same coin. If the Fed's going to be this expansionary, there's folks who are going to say, do I step out of financial assets into hard assets that might be a better store of value? In terms of doing something more significant in the portfolio with gold, it's not something we pursued historically. I think it's a different market that trades in a way that this doesn't necessarily align with a long-term investment goal. It tends to be a shorter-term hedge in our experience.
Any other questions or comments? Don't see any microphones lighting up, so thank you, Tim. Appreciate all the information, as always.